It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll meet the director of a documentary set to air on Wisconsin Public Television that tells the history of the Black Panther Party.
First, if you live in a city, access to the internet is something you might take for granted.
But for people living in rural areas in Wisconsin, access to high-speed internet is something that may not come easily. It may not be available at all.
The Federal Communications Commission is providing three broadband providers with nearly $500 million in federal grant money to bring high-speed internet to rural areas in Wisconsin. Bill Especk joins us now. He's the executive director at the Wisconsin State Telecommunications Association. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show today.
The FCC is giving over $500 million in federal grant money. Sounds like a lot of money, but how far does this money actually go?
Well, the goal of the program is to build out broadband in unserved and underserved areas of rural Wisconsin, targeting 230,000 locations. And that's a significant amount of area in Wisconsin that's very rural, very sparsely populated, and really targeting the areas of the state where instead of having customers per square mile, you have miles per customer, which is why those are very expensive areas to serve and may explain why they don't already have a wired broadband option.
And when you think about some of those hotspots in terms of need, where are the parts of the state that we're talking about?
The funding is specifically targeting AT&T territory, CenturyLink territory, and Frontier territory. And there are maps available online that get into the specific areas that are targeted, and it is a relatively large footprint of Wisconsin in terms of the areas that are targeted. It is a very small percentage of our population, given the fact that there are very few people actually living in those areas.
Do we know which parts of Wisconsin will benefit from this first?
The companies that are receiving this funding, again, it's AT&T, CenturyLink, and Frontier, are currently going through the engineering associated with this massive broadband build-out project. It's going to be determined by each of those companies how they are going to sequence the construction of those projects. There are targets. They have to have 40% of the locations built out by the end of 2017, and then 20% each additional year until 2020, when they have to have completed 100% of the build-out.
Is this money from the FCC just going to Wisconsin, or is this a national issue?
This is a national project. In total, the FCC is allocating more than $10 billion to this program. It's called the Connect America Fund Phase 2, and I'm pleased that Wisconsin companies have accepted the funding for the projects. They're not required to accept this funding. On a side note, if they don't accept the funding, those monies are available to their competitors. So there's a carrot and a stick approach that the FCC has instituted with this program. But the build-out will be significant over the next 6 years.
In terms of the actual process and why these areas haven't been served yet, what is the process like for adding broadband internet infrastructure?
The primary goal here will be to push fiber optics further into the network, deeper into the network and closer to the customer. The closer that the fiber facilities are to the end user, the more robust the broadband will be for those customers.
And I'm guessing this is a pretty expensive prospect.
It is, depending upon the terrain that is being targeted for the fiber installation. A mile of fiber optics can be in the neighborhood of $20,000 to $30,000 per mile. So it's an expensive project. It's a labor-intensive project. And when you're passing a relatively small number of locations, it can be very expensive and difficult for the business case to be made for those investments, which is why the FCC created the Connect America Fund programs in the first place.
We're talking to Bill Esbeck, Executive Director at the Wisconsin State Telecommunications Association. We're talking about the FCC's decision to grant over $500 million for broadband access to rural parts of Wisconsin. And looking at why this matters, what does access to high-speed internet mean to people in rural parts of the state?
Well, certainly from a residential perspective, there's a quality of life component that comes with robust broadband access. From a business perspective, it can be very important for the viability of businesses that choose to locate in rural communities. From an education perspective, while Wisconsin school districts and schools are very well covered with the BadgerNet connectivity that's made available by the state, there certainly is an education component to having robust broadband in the residential settings for students as well.
And I've heard that in northern parts of the state, tourists come up north, the population swells, but they may not stay as long as they might if the internet connection was better. What have you heard about tourism?
I think that's a very valid argument for more broadband. I think, for all of the reasons that we're discussing, more broadband is something that will be a benefit to Wisconsin, and the FCC has crafted a very targeted approach to making sure that unserved and underserved locations will have access to that robust broadband that you may find in more densely populated areas. Another significant component about the program itself is that the $570 million that Wisconsin companies will receive over the next or during the 6 years of the program, that funding will cover a fraction of the actual build-out cost. These construction projects will be well into the billions of dollars and will require significant commitments and private sector capital as well to achieve the goals of the program.
What has the state of Wisconsin done to provide access to broadband for these rural communities that we're talking about? There has been some criticism a while back that the state wasn't doing enough to provide.
I think the state program that is available, that Governor Walker started previous budget cycle and then tripled the amount of funding available for that program in the most recent budget, that's a very complementary program to what we're talking about coming from the FCC. The FCC dollars are highly prescribed for very specific areas of Wisconsin. The state-level program that Governor Walker started as the PSC Broadband Expansion Grant Program is a more flexible approach to targeting certain projects and certain areas that that are likely, at this point, likely to be outside of the targets for the Connect America Fund dollars.
Now, the deadline for companies who are getting money from this project is 2020. That's 4 years off. Is it possible that technology could sort of leap beyond the prescription here? I mean, AT&T sounds like talking about a non-wire-based internet service that could rival broadband in the future.
Yes, the FCC is entertaining discussions on different technologies that can be utilized to meet the goals of the program. My understanding is that the FCC is also making sure that the end user experience is similar, if not identical, to what you would experience as a wired customer. So if a company like AT&T is able to use a wireless project to complete the requirements of the Connect America Fund program, then the end user experience will look and feel like a wired product.
So at the end of the day, 2020, this money has been spent. Is this going to be enough to serve the areas of Wisconsin that are underserved right now for broadband?
Looking at the way the math shakes out, we have about 8% of the residential customers in Wisconsin targeted as the beneficiaries of this program. That coincides with the amount of unserved or underserved areas that remain in Wisconsin below the 10 megabit per second download threshold that has been identified for the program. I'm very confident that at the conclusion of the build-out associated with the Connect America Fund Phase 2, Wisconsin residents will not only have a wired option, but they will also have a wireless and a satellite option. So there will be even more robust competition than what we're seeing today. But I think the goals of this program have been very well conceived. The program itself has been structured in a way that holds companies accountable to the actual build-out. And in a very, very targeted way, this funding will be used to reach the unserved and underserved areas that remain in our state.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bill Esbeck is the executive director at the Wisconsin State Telecommunications Association. He joined us to talk about new federal grants to boost broadband access in rural Wisconsin.
Coming up, we talked to the director of a new documentary airing on public television that tells the story of the Black Panther Party. That's coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll have a conversation about the moral and ethical concerns over the spread of the Zika virus.
First, a new documentary tells the story of the Black Panthers and the turbulent racial landscape that led to the rise of that movement. The Black Panthers' Vanguard of the Revolution airs next Tuesday at 8 on Wisconsin public television stations around Wisconsin.
The film follows the rise of the Black Panther Party from its beginnings as an effort to protect black citizens from police in Oakland to a national movement focused on race relations, economic equality, and other social issues. Here are some of the voices in the documentary.
One of the cities most troubled by animosity between police and Negroes is Oakland, California.
During that time period, being black in America meant that you didn't walk down the street with the same sense of safety and the same sense of privilege as a white person.
We were not after the church folks. We were not after the Muslim folks. We wanted the brother on the corner. The brother was getting his head banged in every weekend by the police.
We would get calls from Atlanta, Nashville, Raleigh, North Carolina, from Washington, D.C., Bridgeport, Connecticut. Every city, small or large, you can think of, wanted a chapter of the Black Panther Party.
Joining us now in the studio is the director of the documentary, Stanley Nelson. He's an award-winning filmmaker whose past works include Freedom Riders and Freedom Summer. Stanley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, think about what we just heard there. Black people saying they're not being treated fairly. Police, minority tensions, tough economic conditions, movement that started local, spread around the country. Sound familiar?
Yeah, it sounds just like today.
Yeah. Do you see, as you put together this documentary, as the Black Lives Matter movement's going on, Ferguson and beyond, do you see a lot of parallels between what led to the Black Panthers and now?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really interesting is we started the film 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought it was really relevant then. And as, you know, we got closer to finishing, it just became more and more and more and more relevant.
Is it a case, though, that this was something that flared up 50 years ago and it flared up today? Or is this something that's been going along for the whole, you know, the last five decades? We just haven't been paying attention to it.
Well, I think it's been going on for the last five decades and a long time before that. I think what you don't hear a lot in this discussion that we have now about the police and African-American communities is what is the relationship historically between African-American communities and the police. And I'm not talking about 50 years. I'm talking about 100 years, 150 years, 200 years ago. What has that relationship been and how it has it developed into what it is now? I think that's really important that we think about that.
Well, take us back to this this era in the 1960s. There's been this civil rights movement going on really since the end of World War II. I mean, mm-hmm. before that, too. But the modern civil rights movement for 20 years by this point. Passive resistance, nonviolent resistance. What were the people who eventually founded the Black Panthers thinking as they watched this?
Well, the Panthers started in 1966 in Oakland, California. And I think that for a lot of people, especially a lot of younger people, you know, they had seen the civil rights movement going on for, you know, 6, 7, 8 years. And they had seen, I think there was this feeling that, they had seen the civil rights movement accomplish what it could accomplish in this kind of nonviolent movement. I think also it's important to understand that the Panthers were a northern movement, and the civil rights movement up till that time, 1966, was basically a southern movement. They were talking about southern problems. They were talking about, you know, you couldn't vote, you couldn't eat in a restaurant, you couldn't ride a bus. You know, the problems were very different in Oakland, California, in New York, in Chicago, in Detroit.
What kind of problems were they looking at?
Well, Panthers started out because of police brutality, the police brutality in Oakland, California. And the Panthers started because there was an open carry gun law in California that most people didn't know existed that said you could carry a loaded weapon as long as you carried it in the open. And what they decided to do was kind of what they call police the police. So they would follow the police around, and when the police jumped out to make a stop, the Panthers would jump out with their loaded guns and stand back, and as they said, just make sure that no brutality occurred.
And you have an amazing variety of voices in the documentary with those early efforts. You hear from some of the people who were there, some of the people who were carrying rifles, and police officers, too, and what they made of that.
Right. I think it was really important for us to try to find police officers who could talk about the Panthers, who were kind of on the other side. I mean, I think that just makes the story that much richer and that much more whole and that much more believable, because you do hear from both sides. We also have FBI informants, you know, in the film and others.
And one of the most dramatic moments that really caught national attention was at the State House in California. Can you talk about what happened there?
Well, yeah, the Panthers become kind of famous for this policing the police. And so the legislatures in California decide, okay, we're gonna repeal the law, the open carry law. But before the law could be repealed, the Panthers go en masse to Sacramento, the state capital, with their guns drawn. And in this crazy quirk of fate, Ronald Reagan, who's the governor of California at that time, is holding a press conference on the lawn about something totally different. But all of a sudden, the press sees these black men, you know, carrying rifles and pistols, you know, walking towards the State House, and they turn from Ronald Reagan and start following the Panthers. The Panthers get confused, there's confusion, and they end up in the State House and then on the actual floor of the California State Legislature with these drawn guns. It becomes this huge national story, and that's kind of what puts the Black Panthers on the map.
Talking to Stanley Nelson, director of the documentary The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It's coming up on Wisconsin Public Television next Tuesday at 8. So that got attention at the State House there. Headline, newspapers all over the country, and a lot of young people around the country took notice and wanted to sign up.
Yeah, I think one of the great calculations of the Panthers was, you know, they knew that a certain section of the population would be totally alienated by what they did and be like, oh my God, this is, you know, Armageddon has happened. There's another part of the section of the population who'd be like, oh my God, who are these people? I want to join. What is this about? And that was not only black people. That was white and black and Asian and Latinos who kind of flocked to the Panthers and were supporters of the Panthers.
Well, there's another echo today, Black Lives Matter movements, people reacting in exactly the way you just said, very strongly in favor, offended in some cases. The Super Bowl, Beyonce, the Black Panther imagery there gotten a lot of positive and negative response. What kind of parallels do you see there?
Well, one thing I think is really interesting about Beyonce and the Super Bowl is, you know, it was a group of her backup dancers wearing berets. Basically, that was what it was. And there's been so much talk on social media back and forth, good or bad, you know, and it says something about the Panther iconography, you know, that's still so much in our heads that, you know, you see somebody with a beret and you have to take a side. You know, I think that's fascinating.
Now, this is a long story. We can only scratch the surface here, but talk about when kind of the fall. We've talked about the rise of the Black Panthers. What led to their decline?
Well, there's a couple of things that, led to the Panthers' decline. I think one is that J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, really targets the Panthers and goes after the Panthers to destroy them. And that's very clear in the film. We use memos from J. Edgar Hoover where he says, you know, we've got to destroy this group. To his agents, do everything you can. That said, the Panthers themselves had internal conflicts, especially between Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton, and those things kind of boiled over and became, you know, a real issue. But they were also fanned by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. So, you know, all of these things kind of are happening at once. The Panthers are basically teenagers and didn't know how to handle the pressure. And I think all these things came kind of tumbling down on the Panthers.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, they were huge news. And these were teenagers. Did they talk when they're looking back? You talked to some of them today. What did they make of that looking back? Were they ready for the limelight they got, the notoriety?
I think, you know, as Kathleen Cleaver says, you know, the Panthers, you know, caught on, you know, too far and too fast, that it just exploded across the country. And so, you know, I think you show her. We heard a clip where they're saying, you know, they New Haven, mm-hmm. Detroit, Pittsburgh, everybody wanted a Black Panther, a chapter. And I think it really happened too fast. There was no screening process. Anybody could come in. Including FBI informants. And they were riddled with FBI informants. So I think that, you know, there is a lesson to be learned. And when you talk to Panthers today, you know, they realize that they made a lot of mistakes.
You've spent a lot of time with this documentary over the last 8 years, I think you said. What do you see as their legacy? What should people, positive or negative, take from their rise and fall?
Well, you know, I think in one way it's a cautionary tale. You know, you know they let themselves be infiltrated by the FBI. They let themselves be destroyed by internal squabbles. So I think there's that. I think that the Panthers are not a model, but they can be an inspiration to young people or people who want to organize. You know, this thing started from five people deciding that they wanted to do something about the brutal police in Oakland and became this national movement, this thing that we're talking about 50 years later.
Stanley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Stanley Nelson, award-winning filmmaker and director of the documentary The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. That airs on Wisconsin Public Television next Tuesday, the 16th at 8 p.m. And there's an interview with Stanley at 7:30 on Director's Cut.
Coming up, as Zika continues to spread, we'll take a look at the moral and ethical implications of the virus. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. The Zika outbreak throughout South and Central America has been dominating the news as more information emerges about the virus. The number of cases has grown, along with concern that Zika could be connected to the explosion of cases of microcephaly, a condition which causes a baby to be born with an abnormally small skull and brain. Countries, including the United States, have warned people against traveling to areas with documented cases of the virus, especially if the person traveling is pregnant.
And groups like the United Nations have been advocating that women in affected areas have access to birth control and safe abortions. As a concern over the Zika outbreak grows, ethical issues are being raised about how best to prevent and treat it, including mosquito control, women's health initiatives, and care for newborn children with microcephaly. Joining us now to talk about the ethical issues at hand is Ruth Faden, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
So in a nutshell, what are some of the biggest ethical concerns that are being raised around the outbreak of the Zika virus?
There are several. Let me put them into separate buckets for our listeners. A first set of issues have to do with the failure to attend fully to who exactly right now is being most affected by this concern. In Brazil in particular, this is not an epidemic that is affecting everybody equally. Brazil is a country with tremendous income inequality, and right now the people who are most affected are young women who are poor, Black, and brown. And some of the recommended personal protective behaviors that might reduce the risk of infection are behaviors and actions that it's very hard for poor women to do. So that's one set of concerns. We have to be recognizing that what we would like for people to be able to do is something that poor people, poor women in particular, are not able to do. A second set of concerns have to do with understanding whether or how preventing pregnancy fits into this process. So right now we've got a set of concerns around preventing infection, that is preventing getting bitten. And there we're concerned about access to insecticides. We're talking about having access to air conditioning, to treated clothing, to reducing standing water, to having screens on your windows, all things that are very difficult for poor women to do. And yet this is what we're saying people should be doing.
Is there any sort of government aid to help people who are in those conditions you're talking about, people who are maybe in rural areas who are poor, people of color who in this case need the extra assistance?
We're trying to find that out. Reports from the ground suggest that there just is not enough support. And it's extremely heartbreaking to imagine what it must be like to be a poor woman who is pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant or suspecting that she might be pregnant and hearing through news reports, through social media, that they should wear insecticide and that they should do these other things and that they're not able to do that. It would be very, very, very heartbreaking for me to imagine being in that circumstance.
And in terms of the air conditioning aspect, how widely accessible is air conditioning for women and people in general in Brazil?
Well, it depends. I mean, affluent people in all of the affected countries have ready access to air conditioning, but poor people do not. And the reason why air conditioning is important, of course, is you want to not need to go outside during the hottest parts of the day. And if it's stifling, you really need to go outside. Also, just as a matter of in the course of your ordinary life, if you are a rural woman or a woman living not so much in a rural area but in an urban area where there is high concentration of population and high concentration of stagnant pools of water, you need to be out all the time going to work, taking care of your children. It's not as if you can sort of hermetically seal yourself even if you had access to air conditioning.
And so the other strand of this that you said is important is looking at what sorts of pregnancy prevention measures are in place. What are the options right now for the people who are most affected?
Well, there are two pieces to this. So we're trying, you know, the best thing is would be to get rid of the mosquitoes, right? And there's a lot of attention and interest being focused there. And I've already said several times my deep worry about a sense of powerlessness that some women are likely feeling when they can't do the simple sorts of things that most of us would think to do if we wanted to avoid getting bitten by a mosquito. Right. The next step is, well, if I can't avoid getting bitten by a mosquito, or even if I can reduce the likelihood of getting bitten, but I don't want to take any chances and I want to delay pregnancy, that's where contraception comes in. And this is the next step where we're deeply concerned. There are data here suggesting that more than half of the pregnancies in South and Central America are unwanted pregnancies and unplanned pregnancies, especially unplanned pregnancies. Let me take that back. That is to say, these are not intentional pregnancies. And access to contraception in some parts of some of these countries is extremely difficult, both as a financial matter and literally because the services are not available.
We're talking right now about the moral and ethical conversation surrounding the Zika virus right now with Ruth Faden, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. And looking at this aspect, this pregnancy aspect, countries throughout Latin America are largely Catholic. There's often heavy restriction involving birth control, also restrictions on access to abortion. So as the number of Zika cases goes up, it seems as though this conversation is rising to the top here, this conversation about women's reproductive health. Do you see Zika so far changing that conversation and maybe the social circumstances around abortion rights and access to contraception?
I want to make a distinction between access to abortion and access to contraception, for starters. Access to abortion is something we should discuss and hopefully will in the course of this program. But abortion is a separate set of raises a separate set of very complex moral questions for many people. Preventing pregnancy, especially preventing pregnancy in a context where there is a concern about the health outcome for the baby, is a much less contested territory. And there it seems to me unambiguously the case that the failure of access, of ready and simple access to contraception by women throughout the world is a basic violation of human rights. And this is a tragedy, right, that we don't want to turn into a means to secure what women have a right by virtue simply of being human beings to obtain. But it's possible that highlighting the failure to honor the human rights of women in this context may help produce very important critical change.
Well, if you look at a method of contraception that's easy to use, relatively cost efficient, you're talking about condoms, basically, and that can be something that women aren't always in control of. Sometimes that's sort of the purview of the man in the situation. Is that something that's being discussed?
Yes, and it's condom use is important and a concern for two reasons. There is just the beginning of evidence that Zika may be transmitted through sexual contact. And for this reason, there's the beginnings of a discussion that condoms might be important as a means of preventing infection. Forget avoiding pregnancy for the moment. I want to underscore for our listeners that we really are not certain, that is to say, the scientific community has not established with sufficient confidence yet, that microcephaly, which is the small head outcome for babies, which is what is driving the worldwide concern around Zika, where the scientific community has not 100% established the connection between a Zika infection and this birth outcome. But there's enough evidence that we are getting all of these recommendations. So the two ways you can prevent being infected right now is to avoid getting bitten, and maybe also to avoid sexual contact with someone who is already infected. We know from our experience with trying to prevent sexually transmitted disease transmission through condom use that women, especially poor women, have tremendous difficulty negotiating condom use with their partners. We also know that there is not a small amount of sexual contact that occurs in the context of violence and abuse. So relying on condoms, either to prevent infection or to prevent pregnancy, is just not something that women can be expected to rely upon.
Right, and if a woman is in a country without readily accessible birth control, are women basically being asked at this point to stop being sexually active? And if that's true, are men also being told about changing their sexual behavior?
This is just a non-starter, right? Asking people not to be sexually active. We've tried that path before in many different contexts, and we know it doesn't work. It's not a successful way or a reasonable thing to do as a public health policy or a public health measure. It really makes no sense, and actually it's not something that we can expect people to do. One of the core sort of defining characteristics of good public health policy is first that what you recommend is doable, right? And also that it's something that people can, within sort of ordinary human understanding and behavior, actually integrate into their lives. Abstinence is not something that fits into people's lives.
We're talking right now about the moral and ethical conversation surrounding the Zika virus with Ruth Faden, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions for our guest. How do you think countries should be dealing with the Zika outbreak? What healthcare should women have access to in countries where Zika and microcephaly are on the rise? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the moral and ethical implications of the Zika virus. Ruth Faden is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. She stays with us to tackle some of these big questions.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should new vaccines be tested on pregnant women? Something we haven't gotten to yet, but a lot of medical research excludes pregnant women. What about the threat of the virus? Is that changing the way countries should deal with birth control or maybe even abortion? And are you changing your travel plans because of the Zika outbreak? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Ruth, we were touching a little bit on abortion. You said this is really a separate topic from birth control. Some families, of course, and women will want to carry that pregnancy to term. Other families may not feel they have the resources, may be interested in terminating a pregnancy. How is this conversation happening?
The conversation is happening in a very complicated and difficult way right now. So abortion is, of course, a form of birth control, but abortion terminates a pregnancy, whereas other methods of birth control prevent pregnancy. From a public health standpoint and an ethics of public health standpoint, it's not appropriate to think of abortion as a way of preventing microcephaly. It prevents the birth of a child who would have microcephaly. Now, for some people, there is no space or way in which ending a pregnancy, having an abortion, is ethically acceptable. For many women, it's something that they would approach with great trepidation and with very heavy heart, but under the right circumstances, sorry, right is really the wrong word, under the circumstances that make them feel as if that terminating the pregnancy is the only thing that they can see for themselves as an option, they will want to proceed. It's a deeply personal choice. It is something that if we deny women in this context access to, would be inflicting a tremendous burden and suffering on them. At the same time, it's not a prescription or a public health answer to the problem of microcephaly if it's in fact an outcome of infection with Zika during pregnancy.
But do you see the policies regarding abortion in some of these heavily, you know, Catholic countries like Brazil, who may have more restrictions on abortion? Do you see this conversation that we're having now affecting maybe ultimately the policy?
It may well. That's as much a political and policy matter as anything else. It may well be the case that if the association between Zika and microcephaly in terms of birth outcomes is confirmed, and if we continue to see the number of cases rise where babies are born with microcephaly, and we continue to hear demands from women who want to terminate their pregnancies as a consequence, we could see political change. It's very hard to predict whether that will be the case.
You use the phrase continue to hear. So is that a rising voice in countries like Brazil, people who are saying they would like to look at these policies and maybe change them?
There are certainly increasing numbers of calls from reproductive health and reproductive rights activists in the countries affected, using this tragic circumstance to highlight what they perceive to be as a profound injustice, the failure to recognize women's full range of options to control their reproduction and their bodies. The question is still open whether the increasing attention that is being placed on the denial of human reproductive rights to women in these countries in the context of Zika will result in political change in those countries.
We're talking with Ruth Faden right now, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. She's joining us to talk about the ethical and the moral issues being raised right now by the Zika virus. And there are, as you said, you know, these voices are they're conflicting voices in Brazil and elsewhere. There's one blogger from Brazil that I've read, a pro-choice blogger, who says she has microcephaly. She's functioning fine. She's a journalist. She's a violinist. She's a blogger. And she said, you know, look, I have microcephaly and I'm doing very well. I'm thriving and I want people to know this. So is there education about how microcephaly affects lives? Is that part of what's being understood right now?
Well, it's part of what should be understood. There is no question that microcephaly can manifest itself in very different ways over the course of the life of a person who is born with this disability or this syndrome, and that it's very hard to predict early in life exactly what course or experience the affected person will have. And people with microcephaly, in some cases, as in the case of the woman who's the journalist in Brazil, do very well. And in other cases, and in many cases, children who are born with microcephaly have a very poor prognosis and certainly have multiple disabilities. Some women will want and choose to continue with a pregnancy under the tremendous uncertainties that are associated with infection and the risk of microcephaly, and some will not. This is just an awful time to be a pregnant woman in Brazil, or any of these countries, if you have been bitten or you suspect you've been infected, because the whole of your pregnancy will be riddled with uncertainties. We really don't know, and no one could tell you for certain. Even with available high-tech diagnostic methodologies, and odds are you don't have that, whether, in fact, your baby will be affected. And certainly not in what ways your baby might be affected. So while there is a lot of discussion about abortion, I think it's easy for people to connect abortion, as we think about it, for a problem in a pregnancy, a medical problem in a pregnancy, with something that is not going to be the experience of these women right now. That is to say, it's not as if you go and you have an ultrasound and then you have some confirmatory laboratory test and the doctor can tell you with great certainty your fetus has this problem. Right? Now, educate yourself about this problem and decide what you want to do. This is a context in which women who are pregnant and exposed to the virus really will have many more questions than they will ever get answers over the course of their pregnancy.
Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Ruth Faden, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, talking about the Zika virus and the issues surrounding it.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll break down the results of today's New Hampshire primary as part of our weekly roundup of news from the world of national politics.
That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.